and welcome back to A Life Economy, dedicated to exploring where technology, spirituality, and consciousness converge to create a more beautiful world. I just got finished with the first live video podcast with Brian Seth Hurst. It was a fun time, a new experiment. We're aiming to do more video streams going forward as much as possible, given that it's kind of hard to meet people in person these days. Make sure to tune in next Friday, April 24th at 1 p.m. for another live stream video podcast. This time we'll be hosting it with Torquem G, who will be providing a live sound bath while I will do a guided meditation on top of it. So you can check that out at facebook.com/alifeeconomy. If you want to watch a video version of this episode, I'll leave a link in the show notes, or you can just keep listening. Brian is a really interesting guy. I first got introduced to him through the VR industry. He was making some really innovative VR movies. One was called My Brother's Keeper that he produced for PBS. But Brian has been a media executive for several decades, going back all the way to helping design the interface for TiVo as well as TV Guide. He's been a pioneer in the whole cross-platform movement of storytelling across multiple different kinds of devices, which is really interesting. But he also rides the line between media executive and intuitive metaphysician. So he really has a deep spiritual side to him as well. So it was a really fun conversation. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave a review in iTunes. It really helps us out. All right, now it's time to tune into our conversation with Brian Seth Hurst. You know, I wanted to speak with you because I had read your recent Medium post about the Corona crisis called Starving the Wolf at the Door. And for people that haven't read it, could you give people maybe a brief synopsis about your perspective that you were looking to convey through that post?
Yeah, you know, years ago in 97, I had read a book called The Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe, Neil Strauss, and I can't remember Howe's name. But it was a generational theory about every 100 years in a generation, there are four cycles in the generation. And it always fascinated me. And as this crisis happened, I remembered it. And I remembered what they said about this time. And I think I really was compelled to write it. I mean, beginning, middle, and end, I'm a writer. I've been a producer. I've been on air. But I'm a writer, and that's my first love. And I love words. And I love to research. I just really like to look deeply. And I thought, you know, there is a positive side to all of this. In my own life, whenever something bad happens, I always look for what I'm learning from it. I always look to see if I can take something positive away from it. Even if I've spun off the planet temporarily, I keep going back and saying there's something here for me to learn. And so I just wanted to share my perspective on where I thought we might go and what I thought the opportunity was in terms of working together. And also, I think where you and I connected was, you know, I was saying that in the future, that the technological infrastructure for how we will communicate, how we will share, how we will produce content is already there. And now, you know, where there was a slower adoption curve for some of these things, now we don't have a choice. There are so many things now that have taken our choice, seemingly taking our choice away. But we always have a choice in the way we respond. That's my belief.
Absolutely.
So I could either be devastated by what is going on. And I don't mean, and I say this in the article, I don't mean in any way to minimize the suffering or the devastation that is happening. But this is letting us know, this is, again, my opinion, this is letting us know who we are. And in different parts of the world and in different parts of the country, we're seeing people react or respond. And I always prefer to respond rather than react. And I'm very encouraged by what I see and the kindness and the acknowledgement of the people that are working really hard. Something, the whole point of the article, I think, was that, you know, I said when the fires happened in Australia, you could have empathy, you could send money, but for me, it was 6,000 miles away. And now this is 6 feet away. And it's global. And so we have no other choice but to understand that we are all in this together. And we're determining, I believe we're determining our future right now. So I realize that I say we, and but really I'm speaking from my own perspective. And I realize different people have different feelings, all of them valid. Even people's absolute terror and fear of this is valid. And I wouldn't diminish any of that. But I made a decision at the very beginning of this, back in January, that I wanted to, if people had the opportunity to be a calming presence, I wanted to be one of those people.
Well said. Absolutely. And, you know, as I mentioned, I think in the intro to the most recent podcast that I released, you know, despite all the chaos and fear and death, there are some silver linings. There are some opportunities that present themselves that are unique to this moment. I'm curious if you could describe maybe what are some of the opportunities that you're seeing, that some of the areas for the positive growth that could come out of this?
Well, the first opportunity I see is an internal one, which is the chance to be still. Mm-hmm. If you have a family, it's the chance to, your kids aren't running everywhere, you're not taking them everywhere, you're all in one place. If you're in a relationship, I could certainly say that some of the issues that you don't know because you're so busy can come up in the relationship. So the first level is your own self-concept, your own relationship to yourself, how you see yourself in the world. There's a difference, I think, between who I am and what I do in the world. I think what I do is an expression of purpose. And I think my purpose is to let people know, regardless of the work, that they have choices. The work that I do, the stories that I tell, I really want them to be empowering. In any great story, people are able to identify with characters in that story. So when I look at what the opportunity is, it is first to be still within myself, because at the center of my being, there is a really calm and knowing self up here, a little nuts from time to time, but down here, centered and able to see clearly. And if I'm not calm and I don't take that opportunity to be calm, I won't see clearly. Someone asked me a question about the article about creating, it says, someone once told me, if you want to solve a problem, create a bigger problem. He said to me, what does that mean? I said, well, that means if you're, you know, busy, you'll excuse the crudity, picking your nose and suddenly your hair's on fire, you're not going to worry about your nose anymore. So I think being able to see things from a different perspective, that's the first thing. The Absolutely. Second thing is the global recognition that it was interesting in the beginning, Cosmo, because they said, you know, only older people were susceptible to this. They were the most vulnerable. So mm-hmm. that was like, okay, if you're younger, what's your relationship to people who are older than you? How do you feel about that? How do you feel about them? And are you going to act to help protect them? And then all of a sudden, it wasn't about that anymore. Then all of a sudden it was about, oh, well, young people are getting this. Then it was pointing out the disproportionate economies that blacks and browns didn't have the same access to healthcare. And their general health was putting them in a condition where they would be more susceptible. And so suddenly you started to look at, well, you know, it's not just about this group of people or this group of people. It's right. Literally, if you prick me, do I not bleed? It's everyone. And so that was the next opportunity. The opportunity after that, I think, is being able to recognize where structures no longer work, where they don't serve. And that's why I have in the article, I have such faith in the millennial generation to kind of, and I don't mean this to be a burden to millennials, but they are, in Strauss Howell theory, they are the civic generation. They're the ones who will reinvent society. And structures, the last civic generation was the greatest generation. And out of that, you had Social Security and unemployment insurance and the Civil Rights Act. And, you know, you had some real societal changes. And so civic generations tend to remake society. And so I think those structures, even structures of government, I also said in the article, I had a client who asked me what I thought, how the federal government would manage this. And I'm not political in this article at all. And I said, I didn't think that the federal government would be able to manage it. I thought that it would have to happen on a state level, that it would be the states that would respond. And then at the very, very core, it would be local, the local level, and the individuals in each community that would respond. So now we're learning how powerful we are as individuals and as a community, that we can truly make a difference. And maybe the institutions that served us once, maybe they, I'm not advocating a great American revolution here, but it did quote the Constitution that says, you know, the government's not serving the people, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it. That's I look great. At that as the institutions that no longer serve. And we have the right to create new institutions. We have the right. And I do think if you look at the politics of it, you look at progressives on one side and you look at conservatives on the other. But the great majority of people sit in the middle in this country. And it's the middle that holds everything together. Mm. And so it's those people in the middle who are going, this virus doesn't know any politics. We have to do what's right for each other. We have to do what's right for our health and our well-being and our lives. And I'm enormously encouraged by that. As a storyteller, I mean, the stories that will be told about this, I am looking forward to the different perspectives from different countries, from different people, from different personalities, from different races, to see how they respond and the story that they tell.
Absolutely.
Well, I did a lot of talking. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, you're good. Excellent. Excellent.
So I have no opinions, Cosmo.
I want to address a few points there. So going back to your original point about finding that inner stillness, right? Certainly meditation helps with that tremendously. I've been getting more into the habit of practicing that, and that has certainly helped me maintain my calm and collected posture here. And I'm curious, you know, outside of meditation, what are some techniques or tools that you use to come back to that inner peace and inner calm that is so important?
Well, I was thinking today, I'm going to take a picture of the years of journals that I have. They're all labeled for the time period. I journal every day, sometimes twice a day. It's Wow. a place for my feelings to go. It's a place to get things out of my head. Even when I'm trying to tell a story, you know, when I'm working on a book, or when I'm working on a VR piece, I even write about how I'm feeling about that, because I know for myself, I can run around in my head like crazy. But once I get something out on the page, it's almost like a relief. It's like letting go Yep. and letting God. Excellent. So once I get something out on the page, that's very important to me. And I highlight things and I go back and I read them again and I go, boy, what I wrote right here, I'm kind of nailing it. This is a really valuable lesson for me to learn. I've got to remember this, you know, and the way I react, I don't wish to react. I wish to respond. So I'll write down my reactions. I'll write down how I'm feeling. I'll write down what my concerns are. And a lot of times I will, two things I catalog. Number one is I catalog whatever fear is going on. Like if I've got a fear, I've got to find out what it is and get it out. And it's probably not real. It's probably based on some assumption. And the other one is I actually, yeah, I'd like everyone to think I'm a nice guy, but you know, everyone has an ego and everyone's feelings get hurt. So I have a little forgiveness list that I run where if I'm holding any resentments or stuff, I say to clients, because I have a life coaching business as well. And I say to those clients, you know, I'm not asking you to forgive someone who's hurt you right now. All I'm asking you to be is willing. If you're willing to forgive, I think that divine God, whatever you want to call that presence, I think you'll get some help there in forgiveness. So I keep this list, and on the list, I look at what I'm learning from that person or that circumstance. If my feelings are hurt, I'm going, okay, what have I learned about myself? What have I learned about the way I interact with people? So meditation and journaling. And then the other thing is I have a trusted inner circle that I don't have to be anybody else but myself with, that I can be a mess. I can not have it right. I can say, this is what's bothering me. I can rail and I can get angry because I know these people, we love each other. And we're not judging each other in the circumstances we're in. We're truly there for one another. So I have some very close friends who I bounce. And when I went to write this article, I called a very good friend of mine and I said to her, look, I've got this in my head right now. I've got to get it out. I would like to be able to read it to you a couple times to tell me how it's landing, not to tell me if it's good or it's bad, but to tell me if you get it. Like, where am I not communicating here? And I do that with scripts. I do that with everything. There are a group of people that I think everyone should have an inner circle, not to the exclusion of acquaintances or people that sure. might be good friends, but over a lifetime, you get to know who can set their ego aside to be there for you, who can come with a level of trust so that you can be that bowl of Jell-O on the floor. And then the other thing is, I try and remember, and I think this is because of my age, I've been through so much crap in my life. I mean, some things that were truly horrible that I thought I'd never survive. And to be honest, there were a couple times where I literally was figuring out how I was going to leave the planet. That's how painful wow. it was. And in those times, again, reaching out to the people close, and also some little miracles that happened around those times, just to know that there is a resilience within me. And I believe when you're loved and supported, I believe there's always a divine presence. But if you've got someone to lean on, even if their belief is stronger than yours, and a lot of times people whose belief in me has been much stronger than my own at any given time, to have those people is to have the ability to recognize my own resilience. And so I know there's good in every bad situation. And I've done enough self-exploration. I will continue to do it for the rest of my life that I kind of know where my buttons are. So it's like, oh, this button's being pushed again. So I think for me, that's how I cope. And the other thing is I have to be creative. So whether I'm creating or writing or I'm networking and putting people together or I'm cooking, which right now I am literally cooking up a storm. And I have to say, for anybody that saw what I posted last night, that asparagus risotto was, ugh. So that's, and the thing about the entertainment industry is I can work for 2 years to get something done. At least when I'm making dinner, the fruits of my labor are realized and I can eat them, you know, or I can serve the people, my friends that have come for dinner, I can serve them. So I think meditation, journaling, yep. being creative, trusting your friends, not watching the news. So I've limited my intake of the news. I check in maybe once a day. And actually what I've started to do is just ask, and I don't want to say the name of the smart device because it'll go off, but I just ask flash brief, what's the news?
Right.
Sure. So that I get that. But there is one thing I have been following, Cosmo. I have been looking at the percentage of increase or decrease, as it may be, of numbers of cases in California. Mm-hmm. And I can see it going down. Like each day I calculate the percentage of increase. Mm-hmm. And like yesterday, it was at 4%. And I'm like, and I don't mean to set this up as a competition with other states, but I'm so proud to be in California and mm-hmm. so proud of our governor and our mayor and proud of Californians. And there was an interesting editorial in Zocalo Public Square that I listened to. And the commentator said that California is a unique population that we don't really work on a day-to-day from a government perspective, which I can't say is true or not true. But that when there's a disaster, California works really, really well because we're always prepared for the earthquake. And I thought, well, that makes a lot
right,
of sense.
Right, right.
But we pull together and we cooperate. And frankly, not that I am not proud to be an American, but I'm flying the California state flag outside of my house.
So on the note of being an American, you made this interesting point in, I believe, one of your speeches that I was watching for research about this concept of story worlds and how America itself is a kind of story world in that the Declaration of Independence yes. kind of set, or you know, the Constitution set up the context.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. Set up the context through which, you know, all citizens of this country view our lives through that narrative. And I would love to hear your perspective on the story world that we've now entered, right? Because it feels very much like we're living in a movie. You know, we've seen the same scenes of the empty aisles in zombie horror movies, and we've seen all these other moments that just seem familiar from other popular culture movies or TV shows. And how are you making sense of all the different competing narratives that are going on right now?
I actually don't see, well, let me go back, because every great story has a story world created around it. And so when I referred to the Constitution, it was like, well, that's the story Bible. And that's the rules, the canons that we live by. And when we did a preemptive attack on Iraq, that was out of the canons. That was something new. That was like not in the rule book. And so when I look at a story world, well, now we're in a global story world, but there still is. So the common enemy, because there's always a hero and there's always a villain most times. And the common enemy is this virus.
Right.
And this virus has no feelings. This virus has no boundaries. It has no cares. It just booms. And if we don't come together, which is the lesson, and we don't come home to ourselves, which is the lesson, then we're all doomed, right? Because this could just go wild. And if we weren't trying to respond and create ways of dealing with it and emerge as not just the leaders that will lead us through this, but the individual heroes on the ground. It's like a complete reversal. It's like a bottom-up hero. The heroes on the ground that are making a difference in our lives every day. So I have not seen heroes on the ground. You know, yes, ordinary citizens emerge in stories as heroes. But you look at people leaning out their windows in New York City every night at 7 o'clock to acknowledge the heroism, to thank the heroes. So the story is, you know, and politically, some states are doing one thing, some states are doing the other. So we actually, inside the story world, yes, there are
multiple
myriad
bubbles.
Of little stories in there,
yeah,
of how different states are behaving. And it is those stories that we will also learn from. So when this story, you know, what is it? Where were you, Dad, during the war? Like the question after World War II for the baby boomers. What did you do in the war, Dad? So people will wonder, what did you do?
Right.
And the story of our way of life is shifting and changing. So a new story of how we behave with one another, what home is, the whole definition of home is changing. What about people who don't have homes? For God's sakes, finally in California, we have one of the largest homeless problems in the country. Finally in California, to save ourselves, the people who had homes, we had to go save the homeless. That was the final reason. So it was like, why did it take this to do that? Where was our humanity before? And
right.
it's I'm not saying there's a simple answer, but I'm saying when there's a common enemy that's huge,
yep.
You get your crap together.
Absolutely. So what this is reminding me of is going back to the fourth turning theory, that this theory that argues that history is cyclical and generational. I was doing a little research, and it's outlining how each successive cycle is a reaction and response to the one previously. And I'm wondering, is this pattern of crisis and then fixing the is this pattern of problem reaction, like is this inevitable? Is this kind of just like some natural part of the way that the universe works? Or are we meant to ultimately get to a point where there is no set of problems anymore?
I have no idea. I mean, when I look at that, if you don't have a problem, you don't learn. You don't grow. If you're not challenged, you don't expand. And I go back to Joseph Campbell because it's the hero's journey.
Right.
You will always be challenged on some level, I think, sure, as individuals, and I think as a society. I mean, gosh, I was thinking, what should if I'm going to write another article, and I only write when I feel compelled, I don't say, oh, I've got to write one article a week. But I was thinking, oh my gosh, the brilliance of the founders, when the president refers to the Constitution as being this, and then the scholars come up and they say, well, no, it's this. And you think, how did they think of that? How did they provide that would happen? The checks and balances, the three branches of government, the fact that the president can't dismiss Congress unless under the... How brilliant was that? What was the challenge that those founders of this country, that great experiment,
right,
what was the problem that they had, which was a monarchy in England that didn't understand their needs, didn't understand what the country was about, and sought to impose the same structures and same rules in a new land, in a new country where people were fighting in the very beginning just to have enough to eat, just to survive. And so this rule, what was it? No taxation without representation. It's like bleed us dry and don't give us what we need. So they had a problem. And the way they solved the problem was the founding of this nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated the proposition that all men were created equal. And then we created a society where all men weren't created equal. So here is the aspiration. And now we have all these problems to get to the aspiration, all the challenges to get there. And so I don't see a world where no problems exist. I do think, and maybe people who are in the arts are watching, I do think that it's artists. You know, Stephen Sondheim in Sunday in the Park with George talks about there are two things you leave behind, children and art. And I do think sometimes in difficult times, it's the storytellers, it's the artists that can hold up the light and say, here's who we can be. Here are our better angels.
Love
I don't
it.
Know if I answered your question.
No, I've
got this giant soapbox under my feet that you've given me.
It's a tough question, and I don't think there's necessarily a right answer to it. It just got me wondering because I was looking at, it's almost like the code underneath history, at least if the theory is correct, right? That it does indeed work in these cycles of 25 years, and each generation has their own archetype. But you know, because we have this vision of there, this dream or aspiration of a heavenly utopia where we're all just relaxing and celebrating and living an amazing, beautiful life with no issues whatsoever all the time. But you know, I was looking at this theory, I'm like, oh, well, if that were really the case, then to your point, there really would be no learning without that contrast, right? Like if you don't have some kind of challenge or problem that you're looking to overcome. Yeah. Go ahead.
Perhaps it's aspiring to that
sure,
drives us forward.
Yeah.
Maybe that is the thing. Someday there'll be peace. Someday mm-hmm. we will get to the point where we're so evolved.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that becomes a driving force.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just the thought that I had while you were talking.
Yeah.
Like if there's not something to aspire to, then what happens?
Mm-hmm. I want to jump back to an earlier point that you made about the collapse of structures that no longer serve us. And that definitely resonated with me because I'm keenly aware of the ways in which our institutions, whether we're talking about political, economic, social, they're not serving most of us. They're not really working for most of us. And to what extent do emerging technologies play in the creation of new systems? This is something that you had talked about a little bit in your post.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is I want to say I choose to be for the solution, not against the problem, if that makes sense.
Mm, well said.
And yeah. I do believe when we are challenged, for example, when President Kennedy set out the decade to get to the moon, he set out something that there was a challenge. I don't think it was a problem, but there was a challenge. Out of that challenge of getting to that place, all of this technology was developed.
Right.
You know, you literally saw Star Trek coming true, you know, so all of this technology, because we had a challenge and we had to get to that challenge. Now you're seeing vaccine development super accelerated, and you're seeing global cooperation. By the way, I was alive during the moon landing, and it did unite the world. Mm. It was not just a United States achievement. It was an achievement of humanity. And for that one moment, when a human being set foot on the moon, the entire world was together.
What was that like?
Now we have this challenge. What was it like? You know, when I was a kid in elementary school, every time there was a space shot, they would wheel a television into the classroom. And so literally, and I can't tell you how exciting this was as a child, because, you know, first you had John Glenn orbiting. I'm old enough to remember that. And then you went from into Gemini and walk in space. And, you know, you'd watch these space shots, and it was like you were seeing progress all through the 60s right in front of you. You even had tragedy. You had the fire, the Apollo fire. And but then we actually got there, and that getting there and getting back safely and having done it was, it's a moment that was not repeatable, but it was so, you thought anything after that was possible. You really did. I did. I thought anything after that was possible. And even as an individual, I had hoped that for me, anything would be possible. Because these people got together and they created, and look, there was one person that set foot on the moon first, you know? So how can technology enable new structures? I think it's happening. I think sometimes it happens. You have the intention of what can happen, and then you have the accident, the happy accident of what can happen. Mm-hmm. So I think right now, you know, maybe the weaknesses of technology are being exposed as we start to use it more and more and more. But like nuclear power, for good or for evil. So it's like, how will we use this streaming technology? How will we use, I mean, I as a storyteller, just going back to virtual reality, I had seen virtual reality in the late 80s, 90s, sorry. And I was like, wow, I'm going to do this someday. I love this. I'm going to do this someday. And then I waited and waited and waited. And then I got the very first innovative edition of the Samsung Gear VR. Mm-hmm. And their introduction to VR made me cry. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is it. Any storyteller wants to be able to put people into a story world, to have them experience it. I didn't really focus on empathy. I focused on the experience. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, what I saw in my head for My Brother's Keeper, which was the big piece that we produced for PBS, actually, thanks to Connor Hare and Alex Meter, turned up on the screen around you. It was the story of two brothers who are fighting on opposite sides during the Civil War and end up meeting each other, unbeknownst to each other, one last time at the battlefield of Antietam. And the story that we wanted to tell was not the glory of war, but how war affected families. And there you were between the brothers. And there they were looking in each other's eyes, but also looking in your eyes. I mean, frick, man, this is the great thing. So now I look and I go, okay, how is virtual reality and spatial computing, you know, because it was Arena Cronin, a colleague of mine, that basically had my mind, in talking to me, had my mind make that leap. They started a company called Infinite Retina and asked me to be a part of it as a producer. And she made that connection for me, that leap from just VR and AR to spatial computing. And I was like, that is the next big way. And yes, Zuckerberg talked about the next big way that we communicate. But communicate, tell stories, collaborate, you know? That's why when the stock market was like going, I was like, well, invest and log me in. Invest in all these collaborative softwares, because that's where our future is going to be. So that's the first thing. The second thing I see, I had the honor of working with Switch. And there was a smart cities initiative because Switch is a data center. They are green powered data centers. They're the next level in terms of the technology that runs a data center. It's it's very sustainable running of a data center. But I got to sit in on some of these smart city meetings and just how technology can aid medical response, for example, how it can regulate traffic flow, food supply, just all of these aspects of smart city. And of course, I'm sitting there going, what about privacy? What about privacy? So well, I think that's a big challenge as well.
Excellent, excellent
but
point.
I do, yes, but I do think that if technology can make us more efficient, but at the same time, and my I got to participate and my thing was, okay, I get it, but the interface with technology, the user experience, that has to be human, not robotic human, but that has to be like what is the user interface? Is it beautiful art or is it just button pushing? How does the user interface add to the quality of our life and support our humanity instead of just, and they go back, you're bringing back a lot of memories. So I got to work on TiVo, the user interface for TiVo, when I worked at Pittard Sullivan with some really brilliant people. And Michael Onaitis and Stephanie Otto, they're just designers, just really amazing people. And the thing about TiVo is they have this little character, right? So there was another technology called Replay that was also a DVR technology. But with Replay, it was just technology. With TiVo, you were forming a relationship with this little guy behind the scenes that was going to organize your recordings. Mm-hmm. So that automatically made the experience relationship oriented instead of technology oriented. And I thought that was freaking brilliant. We didn't invent that character. They did. TiVo did.
Sounds like a Clippy for your TV.
Yeah, but it was nicer than Clippy and not annoying. I mean, you were introduced to him and then he went away. You know, he sat on the front of the TV box, but he went away.
Let's talk about VR. We've been in the VR industry for 5-6 years at least. I've kind of lost count at this point, but you know, we've seen it evolve from the kind of the beginning of the modern era of consumer VR to now. How has it lived up to the hype in terms of a storytelling platform?
Oh, I don't think it's there yet. So I lived through interactive television, the thing they call transmedia, which I hated, never used that word. I used multi-platform. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning of these things, there's the hype cycle. There's a ton of hype. And I hope I'm not insulting anyone in the community, but these communities that make new discoveries, and I have been one of these people, think that this is the savior of the world. This is, look, we've discovered, we're alchemists. We've turned this into gold. And so the communities tend to be pretty insular in the beginning. And I've noticed there is this life cycle to these things as well. So you have this hype, right? A lot of money is poured into the field. Then something has to be there that actually compels consumers to want to play with it. Now, the compelling argument, if you will, is over on the enterprise side right now. I mean, we have the opportunity as a company to work with burn patients because the pain quotient goes down for people in burn treatment when they're inside a virtual reality. Have the opportunity to work with a project for prisoners whose release is imminent, who may have been incarcerated for 10 to 12 years. And, and when I was asked to participate in this, I said, this is perfect because it's prison reform is coming. That's another institution that doesn't work. And there are some amazing people that are at the forefront of that movement. One of the women that actually started the program and asked Scott Susskind and myself to participate in Chris Matheny is a woman named Sabra Williams. And it was her thought, what if prisoners, people who are incarcerated, could experience the issues that they would deal with re-entering the population before they got there? So they wouldn't have that level of anxiety. Mm-hmm. Well, in each of these things, whether it's working in medicine or whether it's working with prisoners, in any prize, any enterprise level, you still need storytelling. Yep. You still need a story because people get involved in a story. If there's no reason, if there's no compelling identification with characters or story world or storyline, you're not going to get the most out of something that you can get out of it. So for training and for experience and for simulations, all of that, that's where VR and XR, which is AR, you know, all these R's, but that's where that is growing. So for me as a storyteller, I'm like, okay, we did a lot of innovative things thanks to Connor and Alex on My Brother's Keeper. First in slow motion, first to have the kind of camera movement we had. But in enterprise, you get that opportunity to learn this technology that eventually will come to story. And maybe it will happen faster now because of what we're going through. I just had a meeting yesterday about how all these conferences are trying to go online with virtual conferences, but they're not creating the experience that you would have at the conference. How do we do that? It was a great meeting. And that is 360. That's virtual reality. And how do you still make it accessible? Like I've been in Mozilla Hub and it's not the greatest experience in the world. How do you take something like that and turn it into quality where people actually can't wait to jump in and participate regardless of their age or their technological expertise? How do you make the user interface so easy that it doesn't distract from the story? So I see the growth in enterprise. I see. So we also have had the privilege as a company to curate and run the competition for the Vancouver International Film Festival for VIF Immersed. And what we wanted to do was we wanted to work with them to assemble a strategy that would actually forward the commercial development of VR. So whereas other film festivals might have had a single installation where people could experience it, consumers wouldn't be able to get it. So one of the criteria for entering into the competition or entering to be in exhibition was that the content had to be already in commercial distribution or available for commercial distribution across consumer platforms. And then the content started to come in. And I was so encouraged, and my partner in this adventure was Caitlin Burns. We were both so encouraged at what we were seeing coming in that was like gloomy eyes. I don't know if anyone has had that. Everyone has had that, but you need to, because it's the perfect use of the medium. It's just so beautiful and so well done. And so we saw an Everest and from John Griffin, just great things. Where the artistry, the true artistry of filmmaking is now coming in to VR so that it'll take some time because there's not a lot of money. Face it, there's more money in enterprise because it's a practical use of the medium and it cuts costs.
Right.
It makes training faster, easier. It makes location-based stuff where you would have to travel. Now you don't have to do that. So there's a reason to have it in enterprise. But there's not enough distribution yet in entertainment to actually make money at it. However, there's some great 360 advertising initiatives that are coming along, like Omnivert, that actually will make that possible to monetize that using all the AI that we know and preferences about advertising preferences and all that. That will probably go there. I don't think those models ever really change. So you'll either buy it or you'll have advertising. But I do think that there is a place. I'm focused on cinematic VR because I love it as a medium. So I'm not necessarily focused on interactivity in VR. I would like to get cinematic right first. Mm-hmm. But I do see this industry now. It's like, you know, you step on the rig, it hits you in the head and you go, wait, okay, it's not what we thought it was. Now what is it? And I think we're in the now what is it.
Agreed. Story has been at the center of your career. You are involved in a variety of storytelling projects. And you've also mentioned that, you know, story is something that you use to understand more about yourself. I would love to hear your perspective on the relationship between identity and story.
Wow. So I do believe that every person tells a story to themselves about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the story that you, that you're given by your parents. Okay, again, this is my opinion. You pick up what you need to be happy. You pick up their aspirations for you. But that story, I can remember saying to my father when I was 30, your dreams for me are not mine. Mm. And the story that's run by ego is an entirely different story than is run by heart. Now, I believe you need both. But if I'm going to be about fame and fortune and having people love me and love what I do, I'm going to be giving pieces of myself away, and it will take a lot to get those pieces back. But if I come at this as a storyteller, as someone who wants to make a difference, as someone who wants to have people laugh when it's funny, to lighten their days. This is why I don't comment on politics on Facebook, because there's enough of that. I don't need to do that. I would like to tell little stories in little ways, like little cooking stories right now, that give people an idea or inspire. And I think it's a responsibility of storytellers to share what they know, to share. And the same thing happens no matter what. If you are a drug and alcohol counselor, most drug and alcohol counselors have had their own issues with drug and alcohol. They've got their own stories. They share those stories, just like in any 12-step program, to inspire others, to let others know that they're not alone. I was spent 6 years of my life as a grief counselor for people living with AIDS and dying from AIDS and their families. And having gone through my own cycles of grief, able to be trained to actually be there to share my own experience and to let them know that whatever they're going through is appropriate, because grief is like wacko. I mean, it has its own life. So I do think there's a story that you think that I thought I had to tell, and a lot of different identities that went with that story, whether it was where I grew up, whether it was who my parents were, both my parents were in show business, whether it was my sexual preference, whether it was the level of my intelligence, whether I was at one time I was a singer, whether I was a good singer or not. And there is this thing that I try to remember that actually is, I love Rudyard Kipling, and in the poem If, it talks about, I can't paraphrase it right now, but it talks about, you know, don't listen to the people who criticize you, and don't listen to the people who praise you. Because either one of those things can really throw you off. I love constructive criticism. Someone who says, did you think of doing it this way? Or do you mind? And by the way, I never give advice unless people ask. That was a very important lesson to learn. And that was part of the story too. You will love me for the advice that I give you. It's not why people ask you for advice. They don't ask you so right. that you'll be loved. They ask you because they want to be empowered. They want help. They want, you know, your perspective, your point of view. So going back, there's the story I grew up with. And then there's the story that comes from here that to me is authentic and honest and true. And it takes a lot to get to that place, because you can either be totally distracted by the outside circumstances and give them a lot of power to you ride that roller coaster, or you can be focused on the inner realization and the center. Mm-hmm. And move from that place. So I think identity, for me, it's been something that's changed. First, I wanted to be what my parents expected. Then when I realized that wasn't going to make me happy, I still had the pressure from them. Even though I didn't want to be that, I still felt that pressure. So I was literally reaching over my shoulder to make that happen. And that just took my attention completely away from what the opportunity might have been in the present. So there is that story. Then when I finally had to like declare my independence, there was that story. Look at me. I'm running across Broadway in New York to an audition. I'm an actor, you know. And then fortunately, having someone in my life, a casting director who was incredibly honest with me and said, you know what, Brian, you'll be a good actor, but you'll never be a great actor because you don't want it enough. You haven't got that passion. And I cried and I said, you're right. Thank God someone was honest with me, you know, instead of just, you know, trying to buy into my false narrative, you know. And plus, I think I was being an actor for all the wrong reasons. But I have to be honest when I say that writing has always, always, always been there. When I was asked to contribute this chapter to a college textbook recently, I started by saying that I was a storyteller. My mother saved everything. And there was this story that I had written probably at 7 years old about a lonely petunia in a rose garden. And there I am reading the story, who I thought I was at that time in my life. Just this petunia in a rose garden that didn't fit in. So I have always written, I consider writing to be my salvation. I have a very good friend who's a classical pianist. She has realized that in her life, whenever she is having a rough time, all she needs to do is go to the piano. That is her salvation.
Interesting.
So writing has always been there, and it's always been part of my identity.
Yeah. As a writer, what is your relationship with divine inspiration, and how would you define that?
Wow. I think I've been a writer long enough that I know when I'm procrastinating and when I'm gestating. And I don't think, you know, when I was writing the article on Starving the Wolf at the Door, I had the title. Well, I really didn't know where it was going to go. And I just went for it. I just got out of the way, and things just came through, and memories. So I remembered the quote from Julia Sugarbaker. And I don't think there's another article in the world that quotes a sitcom character like Julia Sugarbaker and Carl Jung in the same article. But I remembered having studied Jung, and I remembered what he said, and I remembered having seen Designing Women as the sitcom, and I remembered my reverence for the Constitution, because once I was asked to be one of 100 people that would actually read the Constitution, after I finished that, I cried because I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, what an amazing document. And so all these things, just getting out of the way and relaxing and just letting them come through. And I've come to the conclusion that I can write anything. They say write what you know, but when I have something to write that I don't know anything about, I really love the research process. I really go after it. And so, and I love words. I just, words and their meaning and their, the onomatopoeia, the way they lay on a sentence, the turn of phrase. I love all that. It's like painting.
It is. But
I don't experience writer's block as much as I used to when I was younger, because I trust it more. And when I say I trust it, it has more to do with me getting out of the way and trusting it to come through than it has to do, and trusting that it will be there, than it has to do with trusting myself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's sort of like this creative energy that flows through us, perhaps, that gets realized in into form in whatever form we choose, right? Whether it's a blog post or a sculpture or a painting or even just in conversation, right? As the words flow through us, it's like, where's the next word coming from? You can really trip yourself up with that one. when I'm meditating sometimes, yeah, I like, no, it's like pay just, attention to that. Yeah.
I think that it's the connection to something, well, two things. I think it's the connection to something greater than yourself. But I think it's the also the desire to be part of something larger than yourself, to contribute to something larger than yourself. And I think that that helps me get out of the way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, this leads me into the next sort of section that I wanted to chat about, which is you describe yourself as a metaphysician and you have, you know, intuitive capacities. I would love to understand a little bit more about what you mean by metaphysician, and would love to also hear about your history of when you discovered these intuitive abilities.
Well, the joke about metaphysician and metaphysics is that in my philosophy class, the day they defined it, I was absent. And you didn't have the internet in those days. And I didn't want to look like I was an idiot. So I didn't ask anybody what it meant. I just sort of assumed. And who knew that I'd actually end up in the field? So metaphysics to me means something in the unseen. That's how I define it. Mm-hmm. Something larger and connected to, you know, the universal subconscious mind, which I also talk about in the art. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when I look at that, I mean, I read like crazy, and I study so many different approaches, whether it's Stoicism or whether it's science of mind or whether it's going back to Plato or some of the grand philosophers of the French era, the philosophes, to just look, because all of these, the Greeks and right up until today, the challenge is, okay, what is the meaning of life? Mm-hmm. And so whether it's Saint-Germain or Wayne Dyer, to me, it's all worth taking a look at, because it leads to questioning, which, you know, I'm also Jewish, and that's the great tradition, is to ask authority questions and to debate the answers to those questions. So metaphysician is, I hope that I can contribute or inspire, I should say, some greater understanding of the, which is exactly what I had hoped to do with the Starving the Wolf at the Door article. So that's what metaphysics looks like to me. It's something that's much larger that allows me a greater, I wouldn't even say understanding, Cosmo, because it's almost like Robert Heinlein, Stranger in a Strange Land, when he talks about grokking. It's like it's beyond the mind. So you got to get it on a mind, spirit, body level, like that trinity, if you will. So that's metaphysics to me. And I'm never endingly curious. So I keep having to go look and learn. The intuitive stuff was scary. So when I was a little kid, I can remember one time my mother and I were in the car, and I said, you know, when we turn this corner, and it's a vivid memory for me, we're going to see a father who's playing baseball with a kid, and the father's going to throw the kid the ball, and the kid's going to miss it. And we turn the corner, and that's exactly what happened. And my mother, who I think was intuitive herself, she was kind of surprised. So then a little older, like 7 or 8, I dreamt the deaths of both my uncles, my mother's brothers, as they happened. Well, when those deaths happened, I actually thought that I had something to do with it. So I was terrified, and I just kept my mouth shut. Then years later, when I was 26, there was this woman in New York who had come from Hawaii named Linda Waldron, and may she rest in peace. And she had a flower in her ear, and she had a muumuu, and she called herself the Butterfly Fairy. Well, everybody on Broadway was running to this woman for psychic readings. So I went. And she said, oh, you have this ability and blah, blah, blah. And I said, and this is what you're going to do with your life, meaning intuitive and counseling and healing and all that stuff. And I said, no, no, I'm a singer and I'm an actor. And I'm like, why the hell isn't she saying I'm going to succeed at that? That's what I came to find out. And then she says, I came to New York to read The Purple People. And now I'm thinking this woman's like completely bonkers. And I said, well, what's The Purple People? And she said, this is a soul grouping. Didn't know what that meant either. This is a soul grouping, and they're here to make a difference on the planet. And usually the people that come are wearing purple. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm going, I deliberately chose to wear purple socks today. And I pulled up my pants and I showed her my purple socks, and she said, see? And I'm like, okay, fine. Cutting forward to the future, I did a past life regression, and I came out of the regression, and I had all this stuff going on, and I went to this piano bar, and this guy was sitting next to me, and I said, is your name Jeff? And he said, yes, it is. And then in my head, I'm hearing 3-1-1-3-3-1. I said, is your birthday March 1st? He said, no, it's January 3rd. So I'm like, oh, my God. And he goes, and I said to him, actually, I said, is it March 1st? And he said, no. And I said, then is it January 3rd? And he said, yes. How do you know these things? I said, I have no idea.
Weird.
So, of course, I called Linda Waldron back. And I had a fragile ego, and I was insecure. And when she said, this is what's going to happen to you, I was like, okay, now this is going to make people love me. This will be the thing. So then one day she called me and she said, look, I'm going to this party. I'm supposed to do psychic readings, but I'm not feeling well. Would you please go do the readings for me? And I said, I have no idea how to do that. And she said, oh, it's easy. Just close your eyes and say what you see. Here's the address. Show up at 8 o'clock. They'll give you a little table. Just make yourself a little sign that says readings on it. Put it in the thing. So I went. I was 26. I sat in that table off in the corner from 8 o'clock to like shortly before 11. No one came over. So I was like, this is so bogus. What am I doing here? You know, I'm an actor. That's what I want to do. And then this woman came over and she sat down. She had a thick New York accent and she was, you know, as tall as she was wide or as wide as she was tall. And she sits down and she goes, my name is Judy. Read me. So I said to myself, close your eyes and say what you see. So I closed my eyes. I just went through all the stuff. I didn't even remember what I was saying. I opened my eyes and her jaw was on the floor. The next thing she does is she screams behind her and she goes, Geralt, Geralt, you have to come talk to this guy. And that's how the whole thing started. And it was like, okay, what am I supposed to do with this? Well, it's actually to help people gain objective perspective. It's not to necessarily predict the future. Mm-hmm. It's to have someone who has some sort of spiritual insight. And so every time I tried to stop doing that, I was like, okay, I'm done with this. I'm not doing that. I would end up doing it again. I would have people call. And so I just kind of said, okay, this is the way it is. And I had to learn over time that it was never about being right. It was never about being good. It's like acting. I remember I studied with a guy named Michael Howard, amazing acting teacher. He said, if you try to be good as an actor, you'll never be good. Mm. You have to forget that and just be.
Wow.
So the same thing actually applies.
Get out of your own way.
If I try to be good at this, yeah, I'm going to be bad. And so I don't necessarily worry about it anymore. I just say what I see. And for myself, I try and tune into that whenever I have a project because I am a really optimistic guy, Cosmo. Like I will go over to hope, which gives you no power because hope gives everyone else the power that they're going to do something and hope for a yes or hope that someone sees the brilliance in something instead of trusting my intuition and going, okay, this is not the person to pitch that to. You know, and letting go and letting God, letting another energy come through and getting what I think I know out of the way. So I use intuition all the time. I especially try and get to it. Sometimes when you're afraid, you can't get to it for yourself. So I have other people who are intuitive that I call.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually, you know, I worked with a woman who, the singer, an amazing singer, and she stopped singing for like 10 years in public. And then she realized that God gave her this gift and it was her obligation to use it. Why would she not use a God-given gift? So I feel the same way about that. If I can make a difference, if I can help someone, if I can ease someone's conscience, even if I can just listen, it can make a difference. So that's where all that came from. And
amazing.
It still works. I mean, it's still, you know, sometimes I see something coming and I go, oh boy. You know, then I had a bunch of people years ago call me after the Challenger disaster saying, I dreamt of it. I saw it. And I should have called NASA. And there were like four people that called clients. And I said, wow. You know what? If you called NASA, they wouldn't have listened. So,
right.
So I don't know why you saw it, but you saw it for a reason. Figure out why you saw it, but you weren't going to stop it. So,
yeah. I've had a number of...
We have certainly covered the gamut.
Yeah. We're going to wrap up soon. I've had a number of precognitive dreams about the future as well as, you know, my girlfriend. And I know that we all have natural, intuitive, psychic capacities, but, you know, some people understand
Absolutely.
That and experience that to a much stronger degree than other people. And I'm wondering if you've ever thought or asked the question as to why that is. Why is it that some people are born with seemingly ridiculous psychic gifts and other people just don't even believe that it's possible?
Well, I think anybody can learn how to play baseball, but some people are naturals at it. So I believe that certain people are more natural at it, but I don't believe it is a skill that cannot be learned. I think you just have to get out of your own way and make space for it. When people ask me how they can get to their own intuition, I say the first place is meditation. You have to learn to silence the logical mind.
True.
Because visions of the future or intuition often don't fit in and they don't make sense. Neither do miracles. Try and give me a logic explanation for a miracle. You can't.
No.
So, but I think sort of fertilizing the ground for those things to grow, I think that's something that everyone can do.
Mm-hmm. So I have to ask, do you still do readings? And if so, could you do quick one for
I
me?
Do.
On
You're forcing live? Me to come out of the closet yeah. today.
I'm curious what you would pick up. Could you do it through a live stream? Does it work like that?
Yes, I could. So I actually do with McLean Masterworks. I actually do a radio show, a tele radio show, the third Monday of every month, and that's all I do. Let me just see. Okay, I am going to ask your sign because sometimes that helps me to get in really quickly.
Sure. Oh, Capricorn.
Your astrological sign.
Capricorn.
Okay. This makes perfect sense right now because you are looking for not just the meaning of life, but you're looking for what your purpose is. You're looking for what the contribution is that you're going to make. And you had said that to me, but this mm-hmm. has sparked really deep exploration. And right now you're not finding a lot of people that can answer the questions that you have. It's like the questions are coming much faster than the answers. And I feel like you're kind of frustrated with that. So some days you have patience and you trust the flow. And the other time is like, you can't learn fast enough. And there's this thing that you have, you don't like to waste time. And yet you like idle time. You like to have time, but you don't like to waste it. So there's this like battle going on. So I would say in the times that you want to like deliberately go unconscious and take time off, that's just as valuable because that's gestation time. You know, you have to have your own personal Sabbath. The other thing is that, and this is probably too personal for this reading, but you're just beginning to learn what intimacy is. It's something that has frightened you. And not only are you learning what intimacy is, you want all of your friendships and all of your relationships to be built on a foundation of authenticity and honesty. And that's what you've decided. So part of the reason you're making the changes is because you don't want to waste your time with anything that's inauthentic. And you don't want, you don't like hype. You hate hype. You also hate conflict. So you won't confront the hype. You'll just want to be someplace else. And so you've decided, well, if I'm not going to confront the hype, what can I do? It's like what I said earlier. What are you for? Not what are you against? So you're not against the hype. You're just for a solution that actually lays a groundwork of truth. Your sleep patterns are going to be all over the place. So you're going to wake up in the middle of the night, 4 o'clock in the morning, you'll be wide awake. I would say that's a good time to get up and write. And the other thing is that you don't need to try so hard to put the past in perspective. It will occur to you as you move forward. So if you see something as an obstacle or something that happened in your childhood or something that happened in your past and you can't figure it out, it'll come to you. The idea is just to begin to walk forward. The other thing is your hands need to be busy. You've got a lot of energy in your hands. So whether that's, I don't think it's writing. I actually think it's working with art or working with sculpture. And I think if you want to do sculpture, that's good because that will give you the physical representation of your creative ability. In other words, it'll be hands-on and you'll be able to create it. Two things that you think you're not, but that you are. One is you are a good business person. You just haven't been forced to be that person yet. So you other people have done it and you don't think you can, but you will be very good at that. And the other thing is when you relax, you are much better at technology than you think you are, and you're much better at problem solving. Unfortunately, in the past, you haven't been in the position to be the lead in solving the problems. But that's something that you can do. You connect the dots where other people don't connect them. And speaking of connecting dots, part of where your power is going to be in the future to make a difference is your ability to mobilize a network, to put the right people together on the right mission.
Absolutely.
So that was really fast.
Wow, yeah. Bravo.
Okay, nutrition is an issue right now. mineral content, like metals, like iron, magnesium, and being able to regulate your energy that way. So how you treat your body will be how your energy is regulated. Mm. It's true for everybody, but right now, true for you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. That was beautiful.
Usually the sessions last an hour, half hour to an hour,
That was rapid fire.
I hope that helped.
Brilliant. No, I resonated with a lot of that. I think that's a great note to end on. We could keep going, but Brian, thank you so much for your time. This has been a wonderful conversation. Where can people find you? Where can people learn more about your work?
You are really welcome. I talked about stuff today with you that I never talked about in public. So I don't know if you're going to be disarming people in the future and making them confess their sins, but there you have it. I've been really honored and this has been a lot of fun.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Where can people find you? What do you have, a website, social?
Well, my email, you can find me on Facebook. If you go to risepartnership.net, that's risepartnership.net. There is if you want to be on the mailing list, and you can just contact me there. I get those emails. You just fill out the form. So that's risepartnership.net.
Amazing.
But also Hold the Book on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to read the article, if you join the Facebook group, hold the page, Hold the Book. Then you'll be able to see the article there. That will take you to Medium to read the article that we've been talking about. So, and if you're interested in having a reading, or you're interested in learning more about the coaching program, at risepartnership.net, you just type that in and I'll get it. And, I'll get back to you. I'm pretty good at answering email.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I want to acknowledge your authenticity and your wisdom, and thank you for sharing here today. Thank you everyone for tuning in. This has been our first live stream coming to a close. I would love your feedback. Just write a comment in whatever platform you're using, and we'll see you next week with Torquem G. We're going to have some sound bath meditation. So that should be fun. And we'll post some more details about that soon. Okay. Thanks so much, guys. That's our show. Thank you again to Brian Seth Hurst. That was a really interesting conversation spanning so many different topics, from intuition to spirituality and VR, the Corona crisis. I think we really hit so many different areas there. Make sure to tune in again on our Facebook page, facebook.com/alifeeconomy, for our second live video podcast next Friday, April 24th at 1:00 with Torquem G. I look forward to seeing you there.